This is All of It. I'm Kushan Avidar in for Allison Stewart, and now a new documentary about space travel, and specifically the psychological impact that space travel can take. So I recently learned that the record for the longest consecutive amount of time spent in space is 437 days. It's held by a Russian cosmonaut named Valery Polyanov. And after returning to Earth from his first mission in 1988, his first words were, and forgive my Russian here, «Мы можем полететь на Марс». We can go to Mars. NASA estimates that a trip to the red planet would take 7 to 9 months, and that's a one-way trip. If you tack on all the science and exploration that would take place on the surface, NASA expects a full crewed Martian mission to take at least 3 years from liftoff to splashdown. It's a while. The documentary is called Space, The Longest Goodbye, and it's not really about rockets or distant planets. It's about people, the psychological challenges that humans would have to overcome for a journey like this. It's 3 years living in extremely close quarters with extremely limited resources and very little contact with loved ones here on Earth. The film follows the efforts of NASA psychologists who study the effects on the human psyche in those conditions. So let's get into it with the film's director, Ido Mizrahi. Ido, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And also joining us is one of the subjects of the film, Katie Coleman, who spent 159 days aboard the International Space Station. And she's also the co-host of the podcast Mission Interplanetary. Katie, thanks so much for being here as well.
So nice to come here and talk about this special film.
And all together in real life and in close quarters, right? Although
it's
we're going to have a great time. Ido, let's start with you. What first got you interested in making a film about the psychological human challenges of space travel?
I think, you know, we met so many fascinating people at Johnson Space Center, at Marshall's, at Kennedy Space Center. But it was that one meeting with Dr. Al Holland, who ended up being the narrator of the story, where this whole world of space psychology or the psychological considerations of space travel kind of opened up to me. And I thought, okay, this is a really good way for someone who's not like a natural space nerd like myself to enter this story, right? Mm-hmm. To sort of think about it more about how this relates to all of us, how this relates to being pulled between where you want to go, which might be really far away or have to go, and what you leave behind, and tell it from the perspective of a real live space travel challenge that's very real. And so it was just a wonderful way to kind of meet, for these worlds to kind of meet.
Right. And one of the ways that we meet that world is through you, Katie. You spent 159 days in space on the International Space Station in 2011. Can you tell us, I mean, most of us have never left the planet, obviously. Can you tell us about how your psyche changes as the long-term mission progresses?
Well, I think it goes from like this elation. You train for a long time, this elation that you've actually arrived, you know, and you've been in simulators and suddenly you realize you're just feet away from a city in space, practically, and that you're going to live there. And then I think there's the, oh no, it's almost time to come home. Only 3 more months left. You know, I have so much to do. And I mean, so much to do in a wonderful way in terms of, I mean, there's the work you do on experiments, which is enormous and probably, you know, easily 12 hours a day kind of thing. But then there is just the sort of mark that each of us makes in our own way by just what we feel like doing up there in our spare time and what we do and what we bring home with us. And I just feel like those minutes are very precious.
Mm. What do you remember about the training that you received to prepare for that psychological impact?
The training, it's not so specific. I think they're kind of gentle in a way. I mean, Al Holland is somebody I know quite well and actually was always pleased to talk to. And it was somebody that, I mean, we were required every couple of weeks to talk to the shrinks, as we would say them. And I tell people the only thing better than counseling is free counseling. Okay? No, but seriously, you know, this even the training is far away, you know, you're going around the world training at all these different places. It's hard on any human and any person who's got a job that is away from their family. Mm. It's literally the same. So having that kind of support is pretty wonderful. And I think they teach us a lot about, we go on things like the National Outdoor Leadership School, where we go literally camping with five or six people who are not probably our best friends. And that's what going on a space mission is like. Those crews, I have to say, in the past, were not chosen with personal compatibility in mind. And it wasn't that they didn't care. They just didn't have the luxury when they talked about nationality, skill level, all those kinds of things. And so it's interesting to me that the mission is actually something that brings this very, you know, disparate group of people together and has them on the same path.
You know, I want to bring up that element that you're talking about the past and how the psychological element may or may not have been taken seriously, or just they didn't have the luxury in your terms. Ido, one of the things that really stuck out to me was that back in the day, astronauts didn't want to be analyzed. Is that right? How has the role of the psychological angle changed in NASA over the years?
I think it's, you know, I think you have, as I mean, this is, I think, something Katie could answer with, you know, much more insight. But from some of the other interviews I've done and from talking to Al and his team, I think it's you can only imagine, as someone who makes it into the program, you have a lot to protect. And also you're surrounded by people who are protecting you. And this idea that, you know, will you be capable of doing all these things in space is complicated. And what might sort of a small quirk that might become a clinical issue down the line, whether it's physical or psychological, is really hard to predict. And I think for some of these earlier astronauts, it's also just a stigma of psychology that's changed, right? I mean, I think for someone like Katie to say what's better than counseling, free counseling, you know, I don't know that Buzz Aldrin would say the same thing. I don't know Buzz personally, he might, but I think that it took a while for all of civilization to accept that being more psychologically minded could be an advantage, and I think for astronauts as well.
What do you think?
Absolutely, and you know, I've seen that change over time, following the Columbia accident, which was hard on, you know, certainly the crew's families, but the whole astronaut and the whole exploration family, right? And the chief, it's actually the person above the chief astronaut, came to one of the meetings and just said, "Listen, you know, every one of you needs to talk to somebody." And it can be one of our folks, it can be somebody that means something to you, but everybody needs to realize this is a lot for all of us to process, and we need to do that. And they looked at people, really looked them in the eye and just said, you have to know that I will never, ever change my mind about a flight assignment because you are talking to somebody to understand more about yourself.
But that fear is present when you're thinking of going up into space for an extended period of time. What you might reveal might be used against you to...
Well, you know, I think what Ido alluded to, too, is that in the sort of the older days where the flight surgeon, the doctor is the person that can say, hey, sounds like you have a little bit too much of a cold to go flying today, you know, in an airplane. And that you know, comes back to NASA. And I entered at a different time where actually I knew these flight surgeons as friends and colleagues. And it's taken a while for everybody to realize that the mission is more important than you, right? And they're going to do everything they can to keep you flying. And your best bet is to work with them. And as soon as something happens where you just think, I wonder if I should be feeling like this, whether it's psychologically or physically, that this is a team that is working with you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I think just, you know, we interview one of the people in the documentary is astronaut Matthias Maurer, who's a German astronaut, who talks about it, right? He talks about the fear of being watched. And what's interesting is we're conducting this interview inside the headquarters of the European Space Agency in Cologne. This is where we're speaking to him. So what's amazing is that on the one hand, he's open enough and exposed enough to say, yeah, sometimes I'm really worried about what they might find in me or about me that might prevent me from flying. And he says it overtly, but he's comfortable enough saying it inside headquarters with like the publicist for ESA standing right here. Right. So that's a really interesting thing, right? It's like on the one hand, they're worried about it, but they know that it's just a different time and it's okay to talk about it.
So what was your experience making this documentary then? Because that's very interesting. Were people generally willing to open up? Were there roadblocks that you experienced?
No, you know, it's so amazing.
About Kayla.
Yes. Well, I mean, you've heard me talk about it and it's true for you as well. I thought before I met Katie, before I met Kayla, before I met Matthias, I assumed, first of all, it takes a while to get to speak to an active astronaut, right? So there's many, many hoops to jump through. And once we did that, and PBS got on board and that really helped as well, I was like, okay, I'm going to start preparing for my first interview with Kayla Barron. And here are all the questions about the space stuff, and here are the personal questions. And I wonder how hard it's going to, you know, how do I have to like chip away at other stuff to get to it? And honestly, like, she couldn't wait to get through the space stuff to start talking about the personal, because she knew that's what I was angling for. And I couldn't get to them fast enough. She got there before me, and she pushed the envelope further. And she said, ask me more. Let's talk about this more. And same with her husband. So I think it was a really nice surprise, a pleasant surprise to her, that someone would want to talk about those things. And she was really open about it, which, by the way, showed me even more why someone like Kayla is chosen for the program, right? The fact that she is not defensive about those things, the fact that she is, and she's not an extrovert in any way, right? So it wasn't like, oh, she just talks about it all the time. But when it's the right time and the right context, she will talk about it. And if she feels like it's a sort of you know, the right environment for it, she would go for it. That means that she's ready for everything and anything.
Right. Katie, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it's because it's about the mission, where it's not just the mission of you getting on a spaceship. It's the mission of exploration, which may or may not involve you on the spaceship, right? It may not be your turn, but it's more like she knows, we all know, that the more people understand that this is just part of humans evolving, that we are always going to be exploring. Somebody is always going to be looking further, wanting to know what's out there and finding and bringing other people with them. That's the important thing, and that people need to understand what it's all about. And that means sharing in a way that was not traditional back in the earlier years of the program.
Do you feel like there's something people often misunderstand about space travel? I mean, besides the engineering things that are hard to understand to begin with, but is there like misconceptions or things that you wish you could rectify?
I like taking away this sort of elite model that, you know, it is these people who are so special, and anybody who's ever helped me pack for a trip or knows that, I mean, we all bring our own baggage, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, when we are going other places and settling there, we need everybody. And we need them to feel like they should be part of that. And just the other day, they announced a new astronaut selection. Mm-hmm. And people who are friends, who are, you know, they say, oh, should I do this on my application? Or, of course, I'm not on the committee. I'm not at NASA anymore. But the thing I try to tell them is that there's just this feeling like they must be looking for ways to eliminate me, when actually they really are like, come, show us who you are so we can select you. Mm-hmm. And it's the same for flight. Like, we're already there, and they want you to be yourself, and that way that you know, they can, I don't know, be the best part of the mission.
Yeah. You know, you had mentioned it takes everyone, and I think families are a very important part of that, especially in the documentary. Part of the film includes recordings of the video calls you, Katie, had with your husband and son while you were on your ISS mission. How did you feel after those calls, and what role did they play in your mental health while you were up there?
For me, it was really important to talk with them. I've always said that the ability to communicate from the space station and just have a talk with your family, I'm a verbal and emotional processor. That's kind of how I work. And just the ability to talk things through helps me figure out how I feel about them. Mm. And sometimes, you know, I mean, even during the training, you learn kind of to let go. Mm. And that, because you realize you just can't be there all the time, and they make decisions they have to make without you. Mm. And so I got a lot of practice of that at that before I left. But in general, we always felt closer, and I don't know, that bond just is there. And sometimes it's better on some days and sometimes worse. And everybody, I have to understand that they're busy. They have to understand that I'm busy. Mm. But it was hard to watch this in the movie, you know, often, especially when, you know, our kid is great. We have two kids, but one was younger when I went. And, you know, of course, I always worry that, you know, by being away, by clearly having something someplace else to be besides with him, would have an effect on him later in life. And I'm sure it does have an effect, but so far, so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that a theme that you felt like popped up in a lot of conversations, Ida? That sense of, I hope for the best, and it's like family life, just with a very different time zone change.
Totally. I mean, the anxiety of having to express yourself through a screen, which we all felt, you know, we felt differently about right throughout like COVID. I think we all kind of had a sense of what it means to like be away from your social support network and having to communicate through a computer screen. I mean, I imagine trying to do that while also, you know, being in space, being far away, having all these sort of physical challenges added to it. And also as a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old who, you know, maybe it's not the easiest thing to try to communicate through a screen when you're that age, right, without physical presence. So what does kind of simulating this physical presence, what does it feel like when you just kind of turn on the computers and try to sort of just be together, not have something to say? Maybe you don't have anything important to say, but you're just trying to kind of simulate being together in the same space. And I think that effort is so, it's so moving. It's so beautiful. We see it everywhere. We see people walking around with like, you know, they're like earpieces, right? And they're just sort of, they're not even talking. They're just like hearing their families, or they're just kind of spending this virtual time together. I think there's a lot to relate to there, certainly for me.
It's perfect that you bring up the idea of either stripping screens away or trying to simulate something, because I also want to talk about virtual reality and the way that it shows up in this movie, because you cover some of the new technologies that NASA's trying to do exactly what you're describing. One of those is virtual reality. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can talk about it a lot.
Go for it.
This is a separate thing, but we're making a video game that's going to be for VR that's kind of based on all this research we did for the documentary. But I think NASA is just doing some pretty incredible stuff and just trying to go as far as possible with taking technology to its most intimate and personal level, figuring out how we could find ways to extend ourselves, represent ourselves when there's not going to be any real-time communication, right? So what we're the big jump is if we're looking at what's being done on the space station, or even the moon. You know, with the moon, there will be a delay, but it's a very manageable delay. It's close to real time, right? I mean, Mars is going to be nowhere near real time, right? People are going to be waiting minutes, possibly hours, really, for a message to come back, especially when messages have to kind of wait for other messages to get through. So, how are families? How are people going to spend time together when they're far away? And by the way, it's not a sort of a casual thing. NASA is looking at this as a really important hazard to get through and figure out for the mission to be successful. The assumption is that if people are taken away from their families for a really long time and can only communicate in messages in a way that makes them feel distant, they might not do as good a job or worse. So that's what they're trying to figure out. And VR is a way to put them in the same space, even if they're not there together. So I could be sitting with you or your avatar that was just here minutes ago, doing something, having dinner, and I could sit next to you and feel like I'm having dinner with you. And maybe it's going to bring us together. Maybe it's going to feel really weird and distancing. I don't know. But it's really worth testing, right?
Yeah.
I think it's about being open. I did a experiment with the MIT Media Lab, and they had Paolo from my crew, Paolo Nespoli from Italy, and I. And you can imagine food for an Italian is a pretty big deal. So they said, Paolo, what if we could take you to you're in space, take you to your very favorite cafe and actually eat lunch there virtually? He and I were kind of looking at each other like, okay, you know, I don't think so, right? I mean, it's just, you know, we weren't that unhappy up there. You know, we loved eating, so it's okay. And then we did this. They took him to his cafe, to Google Earth, Google Street View. There he was. It was closed that day, turns out. But and they took me to our hillside, a picnic table looking out over the valley. And I could imagine that would be meaningful to me, that I could feel more like we were together doing that. And, you know, when we say family, it's not just about, you know, spouse or partner and kids times two. It's about somebody you feel close to on the earth. I tell people all of us leave somebody behind. And often those feelings that we have for those people back there that we miss them is one of the strongest things, I think, that binds us together on the crew.
Oh, wow. So you actually use that as a as not gasoline, but as like a method for engaging with your other crew members.
I mean, not on purpose, but because we're all so different from each other, we have to look at what are the ways we can connect together. Right. And, you know, one of the people on the crew was, you know, for me, very different. You know, he'd never worked with women. You know, he was Russian, and maybe not even typical Russian, very stoic. And so I had some things to learn, and so did he, and we worked at that really hard. But the thing that really got us together was, you know, he had a kid, and as soon as you asked him about his kid, I mean, a different person. Mm-hmm. You were talking to a different person. And the same for me. Mm-hmm. So I think it points out that humanity is really important. Mm. And that's what I love about the film that Ito made, you know, with all these very different astronauts and the journal entries being read aloud of different people's experiences, is it really puts the human into human spaceflight.
Wow. It is a very powerful documentary. We so appreciate you both coming here. The name of the documentary is Space, The Longest Goodbye. We were with Katie Coleman, who's a former NASA astronaut, and Ido Mizrahi, who is the director. This movie covers a lot of things more. It covers the technological advances that we're looking at, some of the stories that you were talking about, Katie, and it's just such a pleasure to have you both in the studio. Thank you.
Oh, man, thank you.
It's wonderful to be here.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.